Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and I made a mistake this week. Went out for the last segment. It's www.jvp. I said JPV, I think, .org, so you can log on to that. We are joined here by Woody Curry, who is a Vietnam veteran. He is the clinical director at the Baltimore Station. We are joined by Thomas Brennan, and I'd say most people at the Baltimore Station who are fighting in addiction recovery are veterans. The vast majority of men in the system are veterans, at least 80%. Is that right, Woody?
Right.
We're also joined by Thomas Brennan, Marine veteran of Iraq and Afghanistan, Purple Heart recipient, who currently writes for the Daily News in Jacksonville, North Carolina, as their military affairs reporter. He's written for the New York Times on veteran and military issues. He's the recipient of an honorable mention for the 2013 Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism Dart Award. He wrote a recent piece that I read last night that's also on from the Times that is on our website for you to read. Thomas Brennan, welcome. Good to have you with us.
It's good to be here. Thank you.
And Kim Ruocco, did I say your name correctly?
Ruocco.
Kim Ruocco is with us. She is manager for suicide outreach and education programs at the Tragedy Assistance Program for Survivors. And Kim, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
And you all can join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Log on to our Facebook pages. Tweet us at Mark Steiner, 410-319-8888. Many of you who listen to this program are veterans. You called in many times, and you are active duty members who are at Fort Meade and other places around and in the Baltimore, D.C., Virginia, Washington area, Delaware, and Pennsylvania. And you can join us here with your thoughts and ideas at 410-319-8888. And Thomas Brennan, let me start with you. I mean, the piece that you wrote was very moving. That short piece you wrote about your own attempted suicide and what you went through. And I think we read these numbers, 21 veterans and military people a day, 28 a day, whatever that number is, it's a huge number. Your own sojourn of what you went through and are still kind of, I guess, in many ways, struggling to come back, right?
Very much so. It was a long journey after that night on December 28th.
So, you felt isolated, but since that moment and your work you've been doing and reaching out and being reached out and other people reaching out to you, that's one of the things that veterans have is a sense of isolation, feeling that no one else understands. No one's understands what I'm going through and has been there. But in reality, tens and tens of thousands of men and women are feeling just the way you felt.
No, exactly. And ever since that article came out, I've received dozens of emails from fellow veterans who have expressed that they've been in the exact same spot, and they're glad that I'm a voice for them and a voice for every veteran who's had to deal with suicidal thoughts after coming back from war.
Woody, your thoughts, and then we'll turn to Kim.
Yeah, I've been there, done that. The key word, the word is isolation. You can be isolated in a crowd. I mean, when I came back from Nam, the people who know, no explanation is necessary.
Right.
To people who don't know, no explanation is possible. And that's why you feel isolated. I mean, loneliness is a mild word. I mean, you are thinking and believing and you are thinking and experiencing stuff that nobody around you, would understand where you're coming from. You don't even understand. Your anger is double and can't get rid of it. For what reason, I know now. I mean, look, I'm 70 years old, but back then I didn't know. I mean, I was diagnosed as sociopath, not PTSD. I was diagnosed as sociopathic behavior. Well, now when I look back at it, I mean, of course, combat is sociopathic behavior. And you just don't turn it off. You can get out of it. But, I mean, all of that jacked up anger and nowhere to focus it, and nobody to talk to. I mean, what do you do with that mess? I drown mine in alcohol just to shut it down. It shuts down the feelings, but it doesn't shut down the thoughts and ideas. I tried to get back to Vietnam 5 or 6 different times after I got back here because that's where all my friends were.
If that's what you just said here, and Kim, I'm bringing you in here, but as soon as you come back from this, I want to, hearing Kim, I want the two of you to reflect on what you just said. Despite that combat in many ways being sociopathic, it's also part of life, it's also part of a duty people do, to the men and women around them. And despite the feelings when people come back and stuck in civilian life, one of the cures for that internally is to go back. I want to explore that for a moment when we come back. But Kim, let me get your sense of this.
Yeah, I mean, we hear this a lot from parents and from spouses when they watch their loved ones come back from war and transition into the communities, that, you know, they lost a sense of belongingness and connectiveness to their peers. And they also have lost a sense of purpose in their lives, and they've lost their identity. So that's a lot of losses altogether, combined with the fact that many of them will have an injury or illness related to the combat. And they you know, hesitate to tell people how they're feeling because they think they're the only ones. But actually, many of their peers are suffering in the same way. So we got to get those guys talking to each other. And you know, what Thomas has done is really amazing. To get out there and admit that he's had this struggle and reach out to others is going to save many lives, because they're also in that same place. So.
And also, let me just say, my apologies for not saying this first, Kim. I mean, your husband, John Rocco, was a Marine Corps major, decorated Cobra gunship pilot. You have two children. He returned from his tour in Iraq, and then 10 weeks later, before he went back, he also took his own life.
Yeah, yes, he did. And, you know, he had some of the same struggles, and he never told anybody, and he was, you know, so afraid that his struggles would change the way people viewed him if they found out about you know, what he was feeling. And little did he know that many of his peers were having some of the same struggles. So, you know, I admire anybody who's talking about this, who's reaching out for help, and who's, you know, saying that, you know, I'm not okay, because that's the real strength here.
So let me talk about from all your perspectives about that. I mean, that I think, again, unless you've been to war, you don't understand it. Unless you have lived, as Kim and others have lived, with men or women who have come back and kind of feel things other people do not feel because they're there, that kind of connection of the fear and loathing, but also the need to go back, this tearing that goes on, is very real for people. And I think we don't get that either on this Veterans Day. I mean, because you can function very normally in society, that doesn't mean that you're internally functioning well, right?
Mm-hmm.
No.
Yeah.
Well, go ahead. Woody, let's go to Woody, Kim, and Tom.
You learn to control your behavior and your feelings and your... You're almost like a caricature. Oh, well, I felt almost like a caricature because I really didn't feel connected with family and friends and not even the institutions and stuff when I got back here, right? I didn't feel like part of this thing. I didn't connect with none of it. What am I doing here? I don't belong here. I don't even know why I was here with these people. What are they talking about? Their concerns meant nothing to me whatsoever. And then it's almost a desperate situation. I mean, the contrary was my military training, I think, is the reason why I'm still alive now. I mean, you just learn to endure. In the military, in the infantry, you just learn to go through what you go through. You shut your feelings down, and you can do that for so long that they it's automatic almost. You know, I just walk through like that thing on TV, The Walking Dead, yeah. The zombie. Really,
Kim?
Yeah, what Tom's talking about really is it's becoming compartmentalizing and desensitization whenever they're. When they're deployed, you know, and then they come back into the civilian world and they don't feel like anyone understands them at all, and they feel very alone, but yet they're afraid to admit to their peers and to their leadership that they're struggling, because if they look around them and they see somebody else who maybe had an even worse experience in combat or had more issues but is yet seems to be functioning and seems to be fine, then they have shame around their own struggles. And for my husband, that was a big part of it. He felt like he was caught between a rock and a hard place. He functioned well in combat because he had a mission to do. He could compartmentalize. He could focus on that mission. He had a sense of belongingness with his peers there. So he felt like he could function. But when he came home, none of those kinds of things worked. in the civilian world. I mean, you can't cut your feelings off from your family, from your friends, and you also feel like he couldn't say that he wasn't okay because he saw friends of his around him that had been through the similar things and seemed to be okay. So there's a lot of, you know, shame and guilt around that.
And, you know, Tom, I was thinking about some of the things that you wrote in your piece that I read, and there's a, I was thinking about what Woody said, that you, know, that you learn to endure when you're in the military, and part of that is also the flip side of that, though, it seems to me, I was thinking about as I was reading your piece, is you, while you might learn to endure, it's also where you are, you become afraid to show anything that might even feel, look, smell, taste like a weakness.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. No, I would completely agree with that, mm-hmm. because some of the emails that I've received since I wrote that are, you know, why didn't you call the Marines you served with? Why didn't you reach out to, you know, your brothers in arms? And to be honest with you, I contemplated it that night, but I was so afraid, you know, because I was their leader. I didn't want to reach out and seem weak to them and let them know that I was having a problem. And reaching out to a civilian who's never served in the military, I mean, you're afraid to lay your innermost thoughts out because they just, nobody understands the dark humor that comes with combat. Mm. Unless they've been there themselves. So I just, that's why I couldn't reach out for help to my peers and whatnot.
That's that's a very profound thing you just said. And I think that, Woody, we're about to go to break here in 2 minutes, but I want all of you to reflect on this when we come back from break. I mean, this question of dark humor, I mean, the dark humor itself is a protective shield.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean?
Protective. Yeah, it's hard to explain, Mark. I tell the guys, I mean, I talk with the Iraq and whoever the veterans are that I have, you know, that stay with us for a while in treatment. The station is a place where guys can come to grieve. Men don't, this is the therapist talking now, but men don't really, we don't have a place to actually grieve. You know, that's just that masculine thing. We don't even know how to do it. We get angry. We don't grieve. We get angry and mad and almost a fit of rage because we don't know how to grieve. We can't. Mm-hmm. Whether it's combat or anything else, we just don't know how to do it. It is not manly to grieve, to cry. You know, I'm saying this first time on air. All this easy is in treatment. What got me was a female psychiatrist. The only one that asked me the whole time I was in treatment, years, 15, 20 years, why don't you ever talk about Vietnam? I looked at her like she was crazy. And I said, what do you want to know? She said, no, I want to know why you never say anything about it. I said, what am I supposed to tell you? She said, you know what? What you need to do is lay down on this floor and have a nice long cry. And I looked at her like she was insane, you know. About 3 weeks later, I was out at Prairie Point, and I was just out walking around the grounds. It was nice and quiet. And these guys came through on the motorcycles, and they were veterans. And I asked them what outfit they were in. They said 199th Light Infantry Brigade. And I knew that they were stationed in the same province near Central Highlands the second time around where I was at in Pleiku. And I just talked to those guys. Next thing you know, I started crying and didn't know why. You know, I cried for about 3 days straight for no reason at all that I could ascertain. I mean, I was laughing at the fact that I was crying. Believe it or not, I couldn't stop. It just kept coming up, and I didn't know why. Mm-hmm. And after, you know, it was a relief, but I still didn't have answers, you know.
On that very powerful note, we're going to take a quick break and come back to Kim's thoughts. I can hear her about to say something, but back to Kim Rocco and to Tom Brennan, who's with us, Woody Curry. Veterans Day, we're talking with our veterans, wives of veterans, and all of you at 410-319-8888. And talk when we come back also about what can we do to change this? Is there any way? We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and that's Potato Head Blues. Louis Armstrong and his Hot 7, 1927. This is when they first started out. It's the anniversary of that, and we are playing the music on these breaks because this is the music that inspired the creation of what we think of as jazz in our world today, the roots of all this. We had Louis Armstrong and his Hot 5, Hot 7, and more, but this is one of the key roots to it, and then we'll be playing bits of that during the day. A little Dave Alvin will be coming up later as well. We are here with our three guests, Kim Ryoko, who is manager for suicide outreach and education programs at the Tragedy Assistance Program for Survivors, who lost her husband to suicide, who is a Marine Corps veteran and a major. Tom Brennan is with us. He's a Marine veteran of Iraq and Afghanistan. Purple Heart recipient, writes for the Daily News in Jacksonville, North Carolina. He has written much of the New York Times on veteran and military issues, recipient of the Honorable Mention for the 2013 Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism DART Award. Woody Curry is a Vietnam veteran and is director of counseling. That's the wrong title. Clinical director at the Baltimore Station, one of the founders of that place that works with men with addiction, and over 85% of the men in that program are veterans, as is Woody Curry. He's one of the most heralded therapists in this regard around the country. 410-319-8888 is the number here. Clarence, we're going to come to your call in just a minute. First caller up, you can write to us at steinershow@gmail.com. Log on to our Facebook pages. Or you can also tweet us at Mark Steiner. And Kim, let me go to you and Tom. You want to pick up on where Woody left off?
Sure. You know, I was thinking as Woody was talking about, you know, the tears and about, you know, a nurse who asked them the question. I hear this all the time from veterans, is that they've been holding it in. They've been self-medicating with alcohol and other self-destructive behavior to try to numb the feelings they're feeling. And it's a good lesson for those people who are out in the field working with veterans or family members that, you know, keep asking the questions, keep wanting to know, keep making it okay to hear it, you know. Let them know you can tolerate whatever they're going to tell you, because I think, you know, they're carrying around a lot, and they want somebody to have a safe place to be able to talk about it, and often they don't feel like it is safe. And I thought it was interesting that Tom mentioned that he was in a leadership position, and that was one of the things that kept him from saying he wasn't okay, because that was very similar to my husband. He was, you know, a leader. He was going to be the head of the group of pilots there that were all young, and he felt that telling people that he wasn't okay was going to let them down. And for our veterans, that's one of the biggest fears, is letting people down, you know, not going to combat, not putting themselves in harm's way, but letting the others down, especially their peers. And so we've got to get the message across that getting help, seeking help, is a strong thing to do. It's not letting anybody down. It's actually doing the right thing for your troops and your fellow Marines.
You know, one of the things I was thinking, Tom, as I was reading your piece, and you can also comment as you will, and at will, with what you just heard Kim and Woody say, but one of the things I was also thinking about was that people could look at people who suffer with post-traumatic stress disorder or things like that, who come out of the military. And some people like to drop the word disorder because post-traumatic stress is normal when you come out of a situation like war. I often like to drop the word disorder from that. But one of the things I thought about was that even if one is not suicidal, if that doesn't become part of what happens when you come back, or don't fall into heroin or don't fall into alcohol, that experience of combat, that experience of seeing what happens to people in war zones, and I've seen this in people who are combat journalists, who people have been in the midst of it, with men and women and children I've interviewed who were just civilians stuck in the middle of war zones. There's a post-traumatic stress that goes on that can manifest itself in a million ways, not just in things like suicide and addiction, Tom.
I've seen lots of people that have come back suffer differently. I mean, some rely on alcohol, some rely on drugs, some who've never hit their wife before start hitting their wife because they just don't know how to control their anger or direct their anger anywhere. And it's a group of convoluted emotions that people just don't know how to deal with when they come home. And I mean, like like she was saying, it's got to be okay to not be okay. That, and right now, it isn't okay to not be okay.
I'm going to open the phones here, but then I really want to explore with the three of you what you think we can do to address this, just in terms of, short of banning all war, which I don't think is going to happen in our lifetime, what is our response? 410-319-8888. Clarence, you're on the air.
Mr. Curry, let me ask you a question, please, sir. When you look at who determines as to what is adequate care for veterans, whether it be in suicide prevention, medical care, or anything else, that structure that they have in place where all decisions in this matter are the decision of the Secretary of Veterans Affairs, and his decisions are final, and he cannot be forced into any action by any court under USC 511. Wouldn't you view that as one of the basic structural problems in the VA, where the lower courts have no say-so, and a veteran cannot go into court and present his grievances because the courts won't hear him? It has to go back up the chain of command into the structure of the Department of Veterans Affairs. Thank you, Mr. Curry.
Thank you so much, Woody.
Political. That's the way the structure is. I mean, that's the way they have it set up. Well, while it's I don't really have a whole lot of ideas about why the bureaucratic structure does what it does, except it does what it does. It's the best I can tell you, and you just have to deal with it. I mean, you know, it's the way the structure is. I mean, they got different levels of jurisprudence that's sanctioned off to deal with certain kinds of problems, and there are some problems that are uniquely military that probably civilian courts wouldn't be able to take into consideration because their focus is the UCMJ is a different code of military justice than the constitutional civil statutes that we everyday people live by. It's another different way of setting up a system that will have the best, I guess, benefit for that particular structure, the military. And that's just the way things are. There's always been that, I don't know, dichotomy, I guess. It's two different things altogether. If you appeal all the way through the VA system, I don't know which case you're talking about, but there are places all through the system where you can address whatever concerns you have. I don't think things have to go all the way to the top in order for anything to be resolved. I don't think that's the way things work.
Ms. Wilson and Mike, our next call is up. We are coming to your calls. I just wonder, this is a good place to jump off, and then we'll go right to you, Ms. Wilson. But this is, Kim, this is a good point to maybe launch into what could be different. What can we do that we're not doing?
Well, I think some of the things, when we talk about the VA, there's wonderful clinicians there, and there's awesome treatments. The problems are is getting to them and having to be consistent.
Right.
So we've got to get rid of all this red tape and all the bureaucratic junk that you got to get to get to the good treatment, because treatment works. It's available. They've got some stuff now that really, really helps with TTS. But, you know, we've got to help our veterans get there easily, quickly, and right away when they need it. We've got to do better with handing off from active duty to veteran status, because there's a period there where, you know, they're handed a number and then they think they're fine and they struggle for a while in the community and they don't go to ask for help until they're really sick. And then it's hard. It's hard to navigate that system when you're already very sick. So we got to get veterans and their families to go and ask for help right when they first see signs. And we've got the VA and active duty military to make it easier for them to get care when they need it.
Tom, how would you add to that?
My biggest issue is that there's not a conversation about suicide. There's not a conversation about veterans' issues for the most part. I think that when I look back on the 6 months prior to my suicide attempt, I don't remember anybody who talked to me about my military service asking me if I was okay. Mm-hmm. And I think that, in my personal opinion, you know, my family knew about my PTS, my friends knew about my PTS, but nobody ever asked me, are you doing okay?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think it's just one of those taboo things that nobody wants to offend the veteran and assume that they're having a difficult time transitioning back. And I'm not faulting my family. This is my own mistake. But we need to not be afraid to ask our veterans if they're doing okay, if they're feeling all right.
I think that's a really, really good point, Tom, because, you know, military families are used to sucking it up. They're used to getting through things without asking for any help. And so when they get a family member who's struggling, they're used to trying to handle it themselves. They're used to just making it the best environment they can for their loved one and not, you know, not outing them, you know, I guess I use those words because in my own case, I was so afraid of telling the leadership that my husband was okay for fear that I would make things worse for him.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, mm-hmm. military families are kind of in this no-win situation where they're sucking it up, they're trying to make it okay for the veteran who's not okay, and they're trying to hide their problems from the leadership or from their loved one's, you know, employer for fear that they'll make things worse. So he's right. We've got to have a better conversation about this. We've got to make it okay for families to talk to others about it and to their veterans about it.
Let me go to the phones here at 410-319-8888. And Ms. Wilson, you're on the air. Welcome.
Welcome. Thank you, Mark. I'm only concerned about one thing. I'm a widow. I lost my husband in Vietnam. And we used to get in touch with each other only by the Red Cross. It's not like what they have today, that you can have all this technology. But my husband got killed over there, and all they did for me was send the body over to Baltimore, and they did not give me my husband dog tag. They told me that the dog tag is buried with the body. But at that time, they used to be shipping bodies to people that it wasn't their family. And a lot of body was shipping to different states to their family, and it wasn't their family. So I would like to know if that ever got straightened out, because that's still on my mind for years and years. And my kids, they never did get to see their daddy, but all I can do is tell them that's what they told me, that this body is in there. And now my kids are all grown and married, and I have grandchildren, but that still bothered me for years. Thank you.
Thank you, Miss Wilson. Mm-hmm. That's a very... go ahead, Kim.
Yeah, I can help with that one. I mean, we've come a long way, I think, in helping families and understanding what the needs are around grief and loss. You know, the Tragedy Assistance Program for Survivors, that's what we do every day, is work with casualty, work with leadership to make sure that the families, you know, get all of their needs met, that they get a flag, that they see their loved one if they need to, that, you know, that they have all the resources and support that they need around the loss. And I think really we learned a lot of lessons from Vietnam. You know, number one, how to treat veterans and what their injuries and illness look like, but also how to help families through this process. And I'm really sorry for her experience, because in most cases that's not the way it's handled anymore. We're doing a lot better in that area.
Yeah, I mean, what happened to a lot of veterans, especially Vietnam, was just... It's very different in some ways than today. In some ways it's not, but in some ways it's very different. Also, it's just the lack of respect for veterans and soldiers, period, that came back.
It's horrible.
410-319-8888 is the number here. And Mike, you're on the air. Welcome.
Yeah, Mark, as far as your prognostication that we may not see the end of war in our lifetimes, that may be true for what Plato said, only the dead has seen the end of war. But those of us in the faith community know that we have a prophecy by Isaiah, and that prophecy is on the wall at the United Nations. And what it says is that they will beat their swords into
plowshares
and their spears into pruning hooks. And we already see this happening today, starting about 1992. At a meeting of the Security Council of the United Nations, President Bush and President Boris Yeltsin of Russia made an announcement to the world about a new era of relations between the two nations to reduce weapons of war and to increase in those things which are necessary for a vigorous world economy. On that same day, President Bush and President Yeltsin of Russia among other world leaders, met at a conference of the Security Council of the United Nations, they declared that a new era has begun with regard to the relations of world nations, an era free of war between countries as expressed in armament reduction, and a general alliance between all nations to aid each other for the good of all mankind. On the following day, the King Messiah, the Lubavitcher Rebbe, told us, what are the prophecies of the complete redemption through Mashiach is, like I said, and they will beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. The Rebbe further said...
Wait, do you have a point, Mike, I have to ask you to get to, please?
What I'm saying is that when we look at what Obama seems to be doing, firing generals, taking away the power of the United States as a superpower, it's all part of the process of coming into the time of the redemption when death will be swallowed up forever. There'll be no more sickness, no more strife, no more war, and it's going to be a new world order. And so anybody who is remembering what's happening at now on Veterans Day should know that it's only a temporary and soon will be in the era to come.
Thank you, Mike. Kim, I know you have to run. You have another event coming up. Do you want to have some closing thoughts before you do run?
I think we really have to pay attention to our veterans. We have to thank them because they are the 1% of the people that said, you know what, I'll stand up. I will put my life on the line. I will be there for this country. And so they deserve all the care that they deserve. So, you know, make sure we ask our veteran, are you okay? What can I do for you? How can I help you? And make it easy for them to get the care that they so well deserve.
Thank you so much. I wonder when we've come into this. I don't want to get really political here, but this struck me as Kim was saying what she was saying, and I was reading an article the other day about what the military faces today, and veterans face today, and people who come out of the military face today. Because how different is it, do you think, Tom? Because the military is a very different place than it was 40 years ago. Woody volunteered. You obviously volunteered. You wouldn't be in the service. The vast majority of people who served in Vietnam, the vast majority of people who fought in World War II, the vast majority of people who were in the Korean War were not volunteers. Were people who were drafted but fought just as bravely as anybody else. And they went through a lot. War became, or at least serving, in some senses, a universal experience. Do you think that has anything to do with anything that we're facing today?
I think that each generation grew up extremely different from one another. As part of my work at the newspaper down in North Carolina, I interview World War II veterans that are still alive. And they were pretty much taught to suck it up, keep moving, and just work. So they, when you look at generations like that of veterans, they worked 50, 60, 70, 80 hours a week. And, as we all know, that's a coping mechanism all in itself. And then when people came home from Vietnam, I'm sure he can speak to this, but a lot of veterans indulged in drinking and drugs and whatnot, and that was kind of like the thing that veterans did. And then now, I don't think that there's enough available coping mechanisms for our veterans today. There's plenty of programs, don't get me wrong, but we haven't fostered the right environment for people to be able to utilize them, and I think that's something that we've struggled with across the generations. Mm-hmm. So we have a lot in common with the World War II veterans and the Vietnam veterans, and I can't forget about Korea and all the other conflicts, but that's the one missing piece of the puzzle, is we haven't fostered the environment to utilize the resources that are available because people are afraid of how they're going to be seen.
So I wonder what you both think, Woody. It's about, because everybody says we honor the people who, men and women who went to war, that fought for this nation, that served in the armed forces, that saw combat. And sometimes lip service, and sometimes that's deep. But I wonder if, when something what Tom was saying, if we are actually at a little different place where we are beginning to understand and progressing more, that there is more consciousness now about this than there ever was before, in terms of what to do for people when they come back, what people go through when they come back. Do you think we're at a place of greater awareness that things can actually change in terms of what happens for our veterans?
Yeah, I think that's the way things evolve. I mean, wars aren't going to stop. But what I'm thinking, and with some context that I have, well, anyway, what I'm seeing is that I think what we're moving towards is a very professional, contracted army. Really.
It feels that way.
No, I think that's what right. War's business. I think what we're moving towards is, you know, you're still going to have the military structure.
Yep.
But, I mean, when I volunteered, that's what that was. It was a contract between me and the United States government that I would do what I was told to do. I mean, and now you have military contractors and big corporations. This came about during the Iraq and Afghanistan, but also in Nam. You know, part of the stuff early on, you know, in the war, it was a lot of civilian people around. I mean, and some of the training I got were with civilian contractors. You know, it's, but I think that's where we're going with it. But as far as, this is another whole story, but we're just talking about suicide and the addiction. There's another whole group of veterans that don't go that way. I was part of that, too, and that's PTSD, too. There's that rage, violent, disruptive. You need to talk about the ones that are in prison for right. acting out on these things. Right. You know, you're missing a great big bunch of people when you don't address that. Those are the ones that people don't see. See, they run into contact with law enforcement and all of that kind of stuff. I bet you that group is just about as large as the other group that you're talking about. If you want to really take a look at it, that's the ones you need to take a look at, because some of that PTSD came out in some stuff that belonged on a battlefield.
Right, and I think that's one of the things we don't see. That's the other side mm-hmm. of what I was trying to talk about earlier when we were talking about this, Tom, is it there's a lot of guys. I mean, when you think of there's guys that we know very well that Woody and I both know that, you know, they came back and they didn't kind of suffer the PTSD in a very obvious ways of drug and alcohol, but they did death-defying things all the time, whether it was jumping out of planes or riding motorcycles at 80 miles an hour or getting into martial arts and wanting to get into fights and whatever that was. People doing things that put something in
drug
you.
Drug dealing.
What'd you say?
Drug dealing, the whole
all of it. And sometimes it was all kinds of things. And one guy we know, you know, he said he just drove fast cars his whole life and drove motorcycles his whole life fast, became a kind of leader of a computer program in a college before he retired. But it was the behavior he realized he had that was being fueled by something that happened. It took him years to let that go, Tom.
I mean... You're looking to feel again. That's what everybody...
Right.
Mm-hmm. I mean, with the dealing drugs or driving fast or doing this, you're looking to replicate the rush that you felt in combat. And I have yet to be able to find a single thing that will replicate that for me. And I think after a while, you kind of give up on trying to find it because you realize that, you know, there is no rush like being shot at. There is no rush like being in a firefight. And I think that's personally a phase that people go through. But then again, I'm only 28, so I haven't seen, you know, my fellow veterans of my generation, what they do, you know, at 38, 48, 58, if they're still searching for that rush.
Right, right, right. I think that's something. I think it's important for people to begin to hear these things, understand it. And I think that's one of the it's a conversation for another day. Mm-hmm. What you just brought up, Woody, but I think that's one of the problems with a smaller, professional, contracted army, as you put it. When it doesn't become a universal experience on one level or another, it changes. You know, and I think that could be another kind of frightening aspect of where we're going. But that's a discussion for a different day. That is not our discussion for now. But first of all, I want to thank all the veterans who are part of our society, who listen to this program, from my dad's time in World War II through Korea, through all the things that happened in Vietnam and happened in Afghanistan and Iraq, and men and women who came back from that, who served and who... need to be thanked, whether you agreed with the wars people fought or not, still need to be thanked and be remembered, and of people who stood up. And I think that's what we try to do in this program as much as we can. We talk about veterans and veterans' issues in the military. I'm glad that Kim Rococo could join us earlier. She had to leave early to go to an event. She's been on the show before, and Tom Brennan, great to meet you. I look forward to having you on the air with us again.
Yes, thank you.
It was great. We're going to log onto your we're going to put your pieces up on the web so people can read what you've been writing. And they've been really very profound. I was very moved by the stuff that you put up there, and I want to thank you. This one piece we're going to put up there is called called My Suicide Attempt, My Struggles to Get Help, and a very powerful, moving piece that all should read. And my dear friend and brother Woody Curry, thanks for being in the studio.
Thanks, Mark.
Thank you all so much, and happy Veterans Day to everybody. And we are going to take a very brief break. And when we come back from this break, we are going to talk to Chris Hedges about his latest work. So stay with us. Don't go away.